Hey there, kindred spirits. Welcome back to the podcast where two, or in this case, three grown-ass ladies geek out about Anne of Green Gables. I'm Kelly Gerner, and I'm here with my co-host, Regan Duffy, and our special guest, Dr. Brenna Clark Gray. This is a little bit different for us. Today's episode is actually the second half of our previous episode. We had so much to say, and we had such a great time talking with Brenna all about motherhood and Anne's experience of that our raw audio was nearly 3 hours long. And while there were plenty of digressions that we could easily have left on the cutting room floor, there were also a lot of really substantial conversations that we did want to include for you. So rather than chopping the episode to pieces, we thought we'd make it a two-part journey. You're welcome.
So, kindred spirits, if you remember, in the first part of this discussion of Anne's journey to motherhood, we reintroduced you to Dr. Brenna Clark Gray. As you may remember, she joined us last season to talk about the Anne sequel mini-series, which was fantastic conversation. Brenna has a PhD in Canadian literature, and because Anne's House of Dreams is her favorite Anne book, of course, we had to bring her back again this season. Last episode, we talked about the process one might go through to envision yourself as a mother and the journey that happens before a baby is even born on the way to motherhood. We spent a lot of time talking about the tragedy of baby Joyce's death and the harsh realities of maternal and infant mortality rates.
We ended the previous episode with a discussion of the religious symbolism that Maud writes about in regards to motherhood and the symbolism of Joyce's birth and Captain Jim's death, both taking place at sunrise. So now, we are going to have you rejoin our conversation where we left off last episode as we pick up with Leslie Moore's response to baby Joyce's death. Thanks, everyone, for coming back for part two.
We can't talk about Joyce's death without talking about Leslie's reaction to it. As Marilla, Susan, Miss Cornelia, and Leslie pack up all those little baby things, Miss Cornelia and Marilla commiserate on the sadness of Joyce's death. Marilla is just grateful that Anne didn't die as well. Quote, recalling those hours of darkness when the girl she loved was passing through the valley of the shadow. And then Leslie blurts out, I envy Anne, and I'd envy her even if she had died. She was a mother for one beautiful day. I'd gladly give my life for that. So what do we think about that? Do we think Anne would feel the same way? Would she opt to carry that pregnancy and dream beautiful dreams during it if she knew it would end so quickly in heartbreak?
Okay, it's a tough look for our girl Leslie. You know what? I really admire Maud for giving Leslie this line. It is incredibly human. It is so relatable. We do sometimes feel these really contradictory, these almost like ugly feelings that maybe we feel we could never share out loud. And here Leslie does. And I think it does help illustrate the intensity of Leslie's emotional world. You know, that's a way that she and Anne are alike. Neither of them feels anything by halves. And for that reason, I think Anne probably would have felt the same way. Even if she knew she would lose Joyce, Anne would have wanted to be her mother, even if just for a day.
What do you think, Brenna?
I mean, I think it echoes back to our conversation about Leslie living in this liminal space and how hard it is to be in limbo, because even if the worst had happened, Anne would not have been in limbo, right? She wouldn't have been in that state between whatever these sort of potential roles of womanhood are, none of which Leslie can fulfill, right? And if we think about motherhood as the highest calling for the Victorian woman, and here's Leslie who's trapped, not even really a wife, never a mother, I see her point. Inelegantly phrased, probably wouldn't say it in that moment, but compared
to... Some thoughts are inside thoughts.
Some are inside thoughts. But I get where it's coming from, right? Compared to the state that Leslie finds herself in, I think there's something very definite about being a woman who died in childbirth that is still more of a socially acceptable, recognizable role than whatever it is that Leslie is.
Yeah, wow. And for Leslie, who has... at this point in the book anyway, no hope of becoming a mother, who lives with that grief and despair every day. The heartbreak of Joyce's death is the other side of the opportunity that Anne has had to deeply love her baby, both before she is born in that like joyful anticipation and in those moments following her birth when she is loved fully and completely by Anne. We talked in Leslie's episode about how her, quote, rich nature seems to be describing her potential for passion and deep love, and how it is squandered in her loveless marriage and that sort of trapped state of being Dick Moore's caregiver. And so I think in this moment, in this inelegant phrase, Leslie is longing for the chance that Anne has to realize the role of becoming a mother and the opportunity to be fulfilled in that holy way Maud has described motherhood, even if she does pay that heartbreaking price for it. Okay, you know, we've been talking for three seasons now about Anne's growth arc and translating her ideals, particularly around goodness, cleverness, and beauty, and romance, of course, into real life. And there's rather a grim foreshadowing for Anne around this loss in something that seems a little silly and funny in her past. I wonder if any of you guys were thinking about this at the moment of losing Joyce. So remember in Anne of the Island, Anne finds her old story club stories and she reads them out loud to Stella. They both howl with laughter, and never more so than at Anne's story called My Graves, in which a minister's wife buries a child in each place they live, 10 children in all, until, of course, Anne ran out of ways to kill the children and lets the last child live, only maiming it and giving it some permanent disability. It's a really funny scene, right? Young Anne was not writing the story to be funny. But she did think only of the romantically tragic optics of all these little graves. You know, she was writing it to be tragic. And then, of course, looking at it as a young adult, Anne and Stella are mature enough to find child Anne's idea of tragedy very funny, because there are so many deaths. It makes it absurdly comical to them. But then the idea of motherhood.
Well, and also, I just had this thought, yeah, right?
Go ahead.
It's absurd, it's absurdly comical to them. And it's also absurdly comical because they know that child Anne has no clue whatsoever what she's writing about.
Yes.
Right? Like, they're laughing at the story, but they're also laughing at the fact that Anne thought at whatever, 14, she could write a tragic story in this way.
It also demonstrates their distance from this moment of life, right? Yeah. Like, they're so far away from even imagining themselves.
Exactly right.
Yeah.
That idea of motherhood and the reality, the devastating reality of child loss, is so far from their experience. They're just not even thinking about it, right? It's not on their radar. They're not thinking about that, unfortunately, very real possibility of childhood early deaths and the effect that that would have on their mother. So, of course, I think we can safely say that at this point in the book, Anne would not find the idea of My Graves actually all that funny anymore.
Well, we have another foreshadowing for Anne about this moment from Anne of the Island as well. And that's early in the book when Anne and Gilbert are wandering around the graveyard in Kingsport. Anne is musing romantically about how she would come to the pines in times of sorrow. And Gilbert, sentimentally, is telling her that he hopes she never has to have a great sorrow. Anne says, "Life seems like a cup of glory held to my lips just now, but there is bitterness in it. There is in every cup. I shall taste mine someday. Well, I hope I shall be strong and brave enough to meet it, and I hope it won't be through my own fault that it will come." So it's very telling that the person that Anne is telling this to is Gilbert, even though at this point she's holding him very firmly at arm's length, and that Gilbert's immediate response is to want to protect Anne from any such sorrow. He then veers a little too closely to revealing his feelings as he responds, so Anne quickly changes the subject and hurries them to go catch up with their friends.
Mm. And we wait another book for any payoff.
Yep. She's got like four more years. This is like the beginning of the freshman year at Redmond.
All the readers are just banging their heads against the wall. But Reagan, I love that you called back to that moment. It does seem now like a very chilling shadow of what is to come, right? You know, Anne has this moment of kind of blissful unawareness and she's like, oh, but I'm sure something terrible will happen at some point. You know, it always does.
You know what's interesting? Yeah. But Anne of the Island was written in 1915. So she had lost Hugh Alexander.
It does make me wonder.
Oh, that's interesting.
Did she know at the time that she was writing Anne of the Island, did she know what was in store for Anne in the future?
I wonder. I mean, I'm sure it was in her mind as a possibility. Yeah. Maybe she didn't have it fully plotted. Maybe she did. I truly don't know. But, you know, knew this was something that could happen. Again, I'm just thinking about your statistics, Reagan. 250 in every 1,000 births?
Yeah.
This was so common.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
This is, and if you were going to have a big family, if you were like Anne, hell-bent and determined on having many, many kids, you would lose a child. Statistically, at this time, you would lose a child, because absolutely devastating as it is to understand that. And if Anne didn't understand it in this moment from Anne of the Island, certainly Maud understood it.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the things I always think about in terms of being a parent is that it is one of the most intensely vulnerable experiences.
Yeah.
That in order to love something so fully, completely, the way you love your child is to be deeply vulnerable.
Oh, yeah.
It's really hard. I mean, it's great, but it's also, like, I just, you know, like from a therapeutic standpoint and some of the folks I've worked with, right? Like that is, you only have kind of two choices, which is to lean into the vulnerability of it or to put really harsh walls up, because it's just very intensely vulnerable.
Mm-hmm.
In any case, Joyce is buried in the beautiful baby dress that Leslie had made as an apology to Anne and had been made to celebrate the hope and love of Anne's pregnancy. That it is the dress that Leslie made for Joyce shows how she's connected to Anne's grief. Anne's recovery is painfully slow. The physical recovery is, of course, made more difficult by the emotional recovery. And Maud does a lovely job describing Anne's grief, the way it leaches the color from everything, how nothing feels right, nothing can make her feel better. Anne gets a taste of that bitterness that Leslie has lived with for years, in that she now feels keenly the unfairness of the world, how healthy babies are born to families that don't want them or will neglect or abuse or abandon them. And here's Anne and Gilbert, who want nothing more than a baby to love and would have shown all the attention and care and given her every opportunity they could. As Anne says, "I would have loved my baby so and cared for it so tenderly and tried to give her every chance for good, and yet I wasn't allowed to keep her." Bitterness comes from not just bad things happening to you, but the knowledge that those bad things are not evenly distributed, mm-hmm. that it is unjust and unfair, and feeling hopeless to reconcile that unfairness.
Yeah, I mean, that's just another amazing example of Maud's timeless emotional brilliance. I mean, I'm sure just based on our conversations here today that we've all felt that way at one point or another. Certainly I have, you know, feeling the grief and unfairness of seeing a child born into a situation of abuse or neglect or ambivalence, you know, while knowing that any child in my care would be so profoundly loved and cherished.
Well, think about
a hard thing to reconcile. Yeah.
And think about what Anne would have seen in her time in care, right? Like,
oh, absolutely.
All the different experiences of neglect and abandonment that she, not even just in the houses she lived in, but in her time in the orphanages and things. It's so interesting to me when Captain Jim is like, that's not real tragedy.
I know. I know.
Her childhood is so traumatic and we just gloss right by it. It's one of the reasons why I like the Anne with an E adaptation, because I think it puts the trauma of her life front and center. But anyway, I just think, you know, she's seen so much. So she knows exactly what kinds of lives children are born into and survive, right?
It's Anne's experience of this bitterness that brings down the wall between Anne and Leslie. Captain Jim had told Anne that she had been too happy all her life to relate to Leslie's pain. We disagree. But I really think that maybe more than happiness or unhappiness or the experience of tragedy or not, it's more this experience of bitterness, right? Mm-hmm. Because Anne did have that tragically unhappy childhood before Green Gables, but she still had hope. And that prevented her from becoming bitter and resentful. And we even see in Leslie's past that until she married Dick Moore, she had experienced extreme tragedy, losing her father, losing her brother, being impoverished with her mother. But even with that, she was hopeful and resilient. She went to Queens. She had plans for her future. She was going to teach and earn money to go to Redmond. She had experienced sadness, but she wasn't bitter, comparing herself to what others had and feeling that injustice and unfairness of life. And when Leslie unburdens herself to Anne in the aftermath of Joyce's death, she finally confesses that she felt as if Joyce's death was a punishment to her, to Leslie, for her own bitterness and hatred toward Anne. And I mean, of course it's not. But she tells Anne all her worst thoughts, and that clears the space between them and lets something lovely come out of this terrible tragedy. It gives Leslie a reason to be there for Anne, and that shifts the balance between them.
And I do think there's something in a friendship where it is hard to be the person who is always to be pitied, right? Yeah. It's hard to be the person that the other people feel sorry for the most. Not that you want bad things to happen to your friends, but being able to be the one who can be there for your friend some of the time is also, I think, important in a friendship.
Yeah, power dynamics matter. Mutuality matters. I think that's true.
This is a very frivolous example, but I did this women's strength competition like many years ago, pre-motherhood.
Wait, women's strength?
Oh, like, yeah, you flipped lifting tires weights and stuff, right?
Yeah, yeah. And like pushed a car and all this stuff. Anyway,
Brenna.
I came in dead last in every single category. And but the thing was, I still remember turning to my trainer and I was just exhausted. And people had kept coming up and they were like, oh my God, like you're doing amazing. And I said to her and I was like, if one more person tells me that I'm inspirational, I'm going to scream.
Yes.
You know, it's like, I don't want to be your inspirational story. I want to come second last in something. That's what I want.
And you want to be able to turn to somebody else and say, just keep trying. Yeah. Don't give up.
Yes.
You're an inspiration.
Marilla tries to comfort Anne with the religious platitudes that make her feel better, leaning into the idea of God's will and providence. It was God's will, Anne, said Marilla, helpless before the riddle of the universe, the why of undeserved pain.
Okay.
Everything that happened for a reason.
Nice try, Marilla. Nice try.
And as one would guess, this is not comforting to Anne or anyone who has ever been on the receiving end of similar sentences, particularly while grieving an untimely death. Anybody who's had someone say that to them can relate to Anne here. I can't believe that, cried Anne bitterly. Then seeing Marilla look shocked, she added passionately, why should she be born at all? Why should anyone be born at all if she's better off dead? I don't believe it is better for a child to die at birth than to live its life out and love and be loved and enjoy and suffer and do its work and develop a character that would give it a personality in eternity. And how do you know it was God's will? Perhaps it was just a thwarting of his purpose by the power of evil. We can't be expected to be resigned to that. And man, Anne, I feel you. This is just one of those big questions that philosophers and religious scholars have struggled with for eons. In the wake of her loss, the faith that had come easily to Anne in the past is not a comfort now. And you know, in my work, I've walked alongside people who were grieving the death of their child, and there is nothing I can do to make their loss manageable for them. The best I can do is bear witness to their pain and hold space for it in a place that doesn't try to hurry them through it. So many people do say things like it's God will, or they are in a better place now, and it comforts them as little as it comforts Anne. Honestly, you would not believe some of the wild things people say to grieving folks. So I think Maud gets this so right. Marilla tries to steer Anne out of dangerous waters by acknowledging that she knows it doesn't feel that way right now, but Anne must have faith. And then she does get to something that at least feels more concrete for Anne, reminding her of how Gilbert loves her and worries for her. And that does give Anne something to cling to, although I wouldn't characterize Anne as selfish as she characterizes herself for being deep in grief. Anne says, I love Gilbert more than ever, and I want to live for his sake. But it seems as if part of me was buried over there in that little harbor graveyard, and it hurts so much that I'm afraid of life. And when Marilla reassures Anne that it won't always hurt so much, because that is a true thing about grief, Anne says another thing that feels true when you are grieving. The thought that it may stop hurting sometimes hurts me worse than all else, Marilla, because grief comes out of love. We often fear that if our grief ever hurts less, it means we love that person less. It means we're forgetting that person. And that makes it feel like that person doesn't matter anymore. But, and you know, I don't know who needs to hear this, so maybe it's for you. Just because you aren't hurting as deeply or as often doesn't mean you love them less. And it doesn't mean that that person is forgotten. All of us mortals bend towards healing like a flower bends towards light, whether we want to or not. We are made to heal, even if it's imperfectly, even if it leaves deep scars. We are supposed to heal. We aren't betraying anyone by healing through our grief or being human. And love is never wasted in this universe, even if we don't always get to see where it goes.
Reagan, that is so beautifully said. So true. Thank you so much, friend.
You're welcome.
We will see that Captain Jim can also give Anne a little bit of that perspective himself. When Anne is finally recovered enough to leave the house, she goes first to Captain Jim's lighthouse. They sit out on the rocks, sheltered from the wind. A great place to sit and dream, says Captain Jim. Anne can't even think about dreaming at the moment, and she says so. Captain Jim understands how hard it feels right now, but he gives her this perspective. If you keep on living, you'll get glad again. And the first thing you know, you'll be dreaming again. Thank the good Lord for it. If it wasn't for our dreams, they might as well bury us. How'd we stand living if it wasn't for our dream of immortality? And that's a dream that's bound to come true, Mistress Blythe. You'll see your little Joyce again someday.
Anne articulates what's behind that special pain of losing a baby, which is not being able to see that baby grow and develop. I always think one of the best things about parenting is getting to see your child become who they are, seeing them become their own self. Anne says, but she won't be my baby. Oh, she may be, as Longfellow says, a fair maiden clothed with celestial grace, but she'll be a stranger to me. Anne is robbed of getting to know who Joyce would have become. And that's a very particular kind of pain, I think.
Yeah, I think that's one of the reasons that the grief of losing a child is so just incredibly powerful and profound. With every passing year, you're thinking about the child that could have been, the child who should have been, their birthdays and milestones, and their lives unfolding just like everyone else's. There's a heartbreaking quote that gets right to this feeling from the poem Grief by Richard Brostoff. You hold an absence at your center as if it were a life.
Captain Jim says, God will manage better in that, I believe. And we will see a little later in the book that Anne can reflect back to this moment and realize that Jim is right. Later, when baby Jem is born, Marilla says, not knowing how dismissive that sounds, that Jem will replace lost Joyce. But Anne has lived, I know, Marilla.
I'm going to love her. And then she, Marilla.
Swear to She's Christ. Crying.
This is not her strong suit.
God, just go wash a pot. You cannot talk in these situations. You're not allowed. Go do something.
Go wash a pot.
Be useful.
Anne has lived with her grief for over a year at this point, and she says, oh, no, 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 Marilla. He can't. Nothing can ever do that. He has his own place, my dear wee man-child. But little Joy has hers and always will have it. If she had lived, she would have been over a year old. She would have been toddling along on her tiny feet and lisping a few words. I can see her so plainly, Marilla. Oh, I know now that Captain Jim was right when he said God would manage better than that my baby would seem a stranger to me when I found her beyond. I've learned that this past year. I followed her development day by day and week by week. I always shall. I shall know just how she grows from year to year. And when I meet her again, I'll know her. She won't be a stranger.
Oh, Anne. I mean, Marilla is not exactly batting 1,000 with her comforting words of wisdom here, is she? Although, you know, I've said this before, I think this is a great Marilla book. And I think that as a character, she's doing something pretty interesting. As readers, we're right here in Anne's perspective, and we could get lost in her grief and her loss, but Marilla pulls us out of that, right? And she reminds us of all the other people in Anne's world who love Anne herself, and how losing Anne either to another perilous delivery or losing her to grief and depression, how that would affect the people in her world, right? How that would affect Gilbert, her friends, you know, the community that she's made here in Four Winds. Captain Jim's story about lost Margaret and his grief in the wake of her loss. He haunted that shoreline for months looking for her body. That story helps Anne internalize the lengthy process of healing. Jim shares that even though he can't always see her face clearly anymore, he sees her in the sea, hears her when the wind cries, and the hurt has gone out of the memory. The memory is a blessing to him now. And that's what Anne has slowly come to understand, to let the loss of Joyce become a blessing of a memory. Later, as Captain Jim tells Anne that he's preparing to cross the bar, that he knows his time is coming to an end, and he doesn't think his memory will hurt his friends, that it will be pleasant for them to think of him. And of course, that's because his death will be after a long and satisfying life, the rest for the weary. Whereas Joyce's death and lost Margaret's death hurt for so long because they are the loss of the future. They had so much more life to live that will not get to happen, and their loved ones will not get to make years of memories with them. Just as Anne will grieve Joyce's future birthdays and milestones, Captain Jim grieves the life that he and Margaret were meant to have together.
I do think, and not to put things into the text that aren't there, but what is this podcast for if not that, that being pregnant with Jim gave Anne something to dream about again, and that did help with healing.
Mm.
The Anne that is pregnant this time is much more cautious in her hope and dreams, though. That's the scar that grief has left for her. She knows that it can go wrong. She knows that to hope again means that she may be desperately hurt all over again. She's extremely aware of that possibility. And I know that many people who become pregnant after miscarriages or stillbirths or infant loss experience a lot of anxiety around their pregnancies. It makes it very hard to feel unreservedly joyful. And even first pregnancies can be complicated with the fear that something you are literally physically carrying and already taking care of within your body might not come to pass. It's such a weird, hard thing. You're so aware of being pregnant, and yet the baby is only a possibility, not yet reality. And I know, at least for me, it felt like tempting fate to lean too much into assuming everything will be fine. It's so vulnerable.
Yeah.
But let's talk timing here, though, folks.
Again, we have questions.
We have questions. I mean, you know what? There's a few timing issues in this book in general. So baby Joyce was born at the beginning of June, and Jem appears to have been born either the end of June or the beginning of July a year later.
Mm-hmm.
So after Joyce dies, Anne recovers for an unspecified amount of time, but is recovered enough by the time Owen arrives at Four Winds to have a wonderful summer. So I've always been a little confused because Maud talks about how it takes Anne a very long time to recover and to move.
It seems like it's months, the way they talk about it, but it's maybe a month.
Yes.
Yeah, it's maybe a month. Yeah.
Because then Owen Ford arrives and they have this wonderful summer together, which has to be at least July and August.
Mm-hmm.
So for Jem to be born at the end of June, early July, Anne has to get pregnant by the end of September. So good for Anne and Gilbert.
These people are blessed in the conception department. Let's put it there.
I am glad that she doesn't have to cope with secondary infertility, which is surprisingly common. That is why Alice is an only child, which is its own weird, hard experience. And I don't think Maud has any references to infertility specifically, secondary or otherwise, in her books, does she? Women who don't have children are typically unmarried in her books. I can't think of any married women who don't have children.
Yeah, I was struggling to think of a married woman in the Anne series who doesn't have children. I mean, I would have clocked it, I think, if there was one. I'm almost certain that infertility specifically is not mentioned in these books. Reagan, to your point about the timeline, I mean, it's a lot. First, we have this incredibly traumatic birth experience and the loss of Joyce in early June. And then, you know, months later, by September, she's pregnant again. I mean, these two are not wasting any time. I mean, I guess I'm glad Anne bounced back. You know, and then it's interesting, we don't spend nearly as much time anticipating Jem's birth as we do Joyce's, right? For all those kind of like opaque little hints we got for Joyce, we only get one for Jem. We get this one little hint that Anne is expecting again in March, right before Gilbert tells Anne about his idea that Dick Moore's mind could be restored to him. So we see Anne, she's dreaming by the fire, doing her thing. She's got her sewing sitting next to her, and she's dreaming, quote, of castles in Spain whose airy turrets pierced moonlit cloud of sunset bar, ships sailing from the haven of good hope straight to Four Winds Harbor with precious burthen. For Anne was again a dreamer of dreams, albeit a grim shape of fear went with her night and day to shadow and darken her vision.
I definitely miss that allusion as a kid. That's pretty subtle.
I love that line so much because to me it's so evocative of, you know, I always describe miscarriage as being the thief of joy because you can, once you know that that can happen, you can never
unknow
feel
it
the same way. Yeah. And you can never feel the same way about a pregnancy, no matter where it goes once that has happened. And obviously Anne has experienced that to like another level, but that sense that even a joyful and wanted pregnancy can never again not be tinged with fear and the knowledge of what can be, I think circles back to that idea of Anne in adulthood and in womanhood as being sort of someone who is fundamentally changed by grief.
Yeah. And then the whole rest of the time between that very vague mention and Jem's birth is, I mean, that's all, just all taken up by the saga of Leslie and Dick/George.
Guys, I know that this is not what this episode is about, but I hate that plot. I hate it so much.
It's so soap opera, right?
It's just like,
I love it. I love the candor. She's like, y'all, I know we're talking about something totally different, but that sucked, right?
So much.
Like, it's so funny.
Jesus.
My husband was listening to, so he knows nothing about, I mean, he barely knew about Anne of Green Gables, but He certainly knows nothing about Anne's House of Dreams. So he was listening to our recap episode, and he mostly listens to it in the car, so not straight through. And he was saying like, oh yeah, I was listening to your recap. It's good or whatever. I said, did you get to the plot twist? He was like, I don't know. I was like, if you don't know, you didn't get there.
You haven't yet. Yeah.
You'll know.
It makes me freshly mad every time. Like, I'm expecting this read through. Montgomery's going to have nailed it. I'm not going to have to sit through that plot. But no, it's there every time.
It's the secret twin amnesia plot line from any soap opera that you want to pick, right?
It's just wild. It's just wild. And I get it. Like, you got to get him out of the way so Owen can move in. Like, I get it. But it's like, God damn.
I wonder if she knew when she started it that that's where she was going to go with it.
Oh, man. I wonder, right? Like, couldn't she have just, like, not to be callous about it, but she could have just killed him off.
That's where,
people die. If we just need to get him out of the picture, he could have died. We didn't have to go through this whole crazy rigmarole.
No. He wanders off all the time.
Also, the part, like, God love you, Gilbert Blythe. I've loved you my whole life. But
let's drill some holes in his brain.
But, like, you're not a genius. Like, you're just Gilbert. Like
you're just a guy.
About it in that one class in medical school where they're like, this is the wave of the future. And he came back and he was like, I'm going to find somebody to do this with.
It's also like, it's just very, you could tell when it was written that they're like, yeah, Trepanning. That's going to be the thing. That's going to be great. It's going to go well.
That's totally a thing. What?
Would have been more realistic if she'd gone to Montreal, he'd started the surgery, gotten a horrible brain infection and died.
Yeah, but then Gilbert wouldn't be heroic Gilbert.
That's true.
Right? So that's the other thing, right? And we've talked a little bit about how this is like really Gilbert's book to shine. And having this genius understanding that led to the Dick/George switcheroo comes from Gilbert.
Right. He's the new modern doctor, right? Like Dr. Dave was old school and Gilbert's coming in with his fresh ideas. And
yeah. And no, I fully don't buy it. Like, Gilbert, you are just Ken. There's no way you discovered this.
And that's Knuff.
Just let it be Knuff. It's fine.
You're Knuff without the trepanning plot line.
just love Anne and be a cute dad.
Yeah. Stop drilling holes in people's brains.
Poor man's
You're a country
brain.
Doctor, for God's
you
sake.
You are a country doctor. Oh, my goodness.
And it is so funny because all her books are so gentle, right?
Yes.
Like, that's the whole point, is that they're all very relaxed and very day in
the life. Nothing super shocking happens. It feels, very quiet, normal. It's like, oh, it's so relatable. It wasn't enough for Leslie to have suffered all the tragedy she already suffered. She had to be extra tragic.
Nobody's gonna believe this one.
Anyway, so we don't hear anything more about Jem because we're all wrapped up in the Leslie Dick/George saga. Okay, the next we hear, we open with a chapter with a fanciful little sketch of a stork considering, then rejecting, the lighthouse, the Moore's house, and Miss Cornelia's vivid greenhouse. Quote, then the stork brightened up. He had caught sight of the very place, a little white house nestled against a big, whispering fir wood with a spiral of blue smoke winding up from its kitchen chimney. A house which just looked as if it were meant for babies. The stork gave a sigh of satisfaction and softly alighted on the ridgepole. Okay, ladies. Do we like this? I think I feel differently about this little stork scene every time I read it. I think right now, I am inclined to think that it's like very sweet and charming and sort of like storybookish, but I know I've read this scene plenty of times previously and rolled my eyes so hard at the corniness. A stork? A real stork? Come on.
I like it. I think it's a sweet way of framing this childbirth experience as different from Anne's delivery of Joyce. It just sets it up as to be like lighthearted and happy experience. But I will say that this was the one I was not surprised by Joyce's birth when I read the book as a child, but I was surprised by Jem's birth because that one little reference to dreaming by the fire totally passed me by. So then all of a sudden the stork is landing. I was like, where did he come from?
Oh, but you did understand the stork meant baby.
Yes.
Okay, just checking.
That's a pretty common, right? Like, trope. I saw Disney movies. I know about the stork. What do you think, Brenna? Yay or nay on the stork?
I don't mind it because it means that the Dick George Moore plotline is over. It signals the end of that. So for that reason, it's a literary masterwork.
Well, this delivery happens so fast and so easily that Gilbert doesn't even have time to wake Marilla, who is again at the House of Dreams to support Anne. Jem is also born at sunrise, a mirror to Joyce's birth, a corrective experience that doesn't erase the experience that Anne had, but provides a counter narrative. Jem is healthy, he's 10 pounds, strong lungs, red hair. The red hair is much to Anne's dismay, but delights Gilbert, of course. The mood in the house this time is cheerful and celebratory, with Gilbert announcing, "Marilla, Anne has sent me to tell you that a certain young gentleman has arrived here. He hasn't brought much luggage with him, but he evidently means to stay."
Oh, that line is so charming to me. You can tell that Gilbert is going to be such a fun and doting dad. Isn't 10 pounds seems a little big.
10 pounds is
big. A really big baby.
That's a big baby.
Very big baby.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. All right, Anne. Are all of Anne's children born at either sunrise or sunset?
We'll find
out. Is that a mandate?
I don't know. When we get to Ingleside,
I think we only see Rilla's birth.
We don't get many more descriptions of actual births, I don't think.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, we'll look out for any other references, but that might be it. Anne says her heartache is finally gone and, quote, "the best dream of all has come true." Once Marilla grasps that there is no danger, her no-nonsense self shows up again, and as she tells Anne, who is marveling over the perfection of baby toes, well, it would be stranger if they weren't, in a crisp voice. And she concedes the point that his little hands do appear to be a good deal like hands.
This is the Marilla I like.
Yeah.
And I'm dying because, you know, newborn babies' fingers and toes are startlingly perfect in a way that you can't really imagine, like, something that tiny could be. When Alice was a baby, Steve kept threatening to eat her toes because they were so perfectly cute. So I cannot believe Marilla, even practical Marilla, can resist the temptation to gush over Jem's tiny fingernails. Come on, Marilla.
My favorite Marilla thing here is that Anne is bemoaning the fact that the baby has red hair, and Gilbert is celebrating the fact that the baby has red hair, and Marilla's like,
yes!
It doesn't have hair. It doesn't have hair.
She's like, I can't see anything.
Yeah, so
not
good.
Much there to be fighting over. No, I mean, yeah, baby's hands, those little fingernails, they always amaze me. Like, how can you be so little and have such little nails? Doesn't it always feel like they should come in later, like teeth?
That would be more
they grow in later.
They came in all like,
yeah, they
like
came
nothing
in like
on
teeth.
The end. No. No.
We again get some of Maud's characterization here of childbirth as a spiritual experience, with Anne described as rapturous. And the text also says that following Jem's birth, quote, "folks came and worshiped the baby as people have bowed before the kingship of the newborn since long before the wise men of the East knelt in homage to the royal babe of the Bethlehem manger." So I do find it a little curious. But maybe that's because I'm not religious, and this is very overtly religious in tone. Mm. I do think there is something kind of miraculous about a new baby, so maybe it's just different phrasing. There is something special in the way that we often feel kind of like tied to previous generations by the experience of parenting, and something remarkable about the start of a new life with all its potential, but it is very religious.
I mean, it's not just religious. It's like overtly comparing Jem to Jesus.
Like, yeah.
Pretty overtly.
That's maybe much.
Which becomes interesting when, you know, we
absolutely
end up with First World War stuff, right? Later
yeah,
on.
Very much so.
I do feel like I have to share with you here my favorite bit of religious trivia as it relates to this book. I couldn't find anywhere else to shoehorn this in, so this is where I'm putting it.
Put it here.
Because I feel for Miss Cornelia, right? Because all she does the whole time is complain about the Methodists versus the Presbyterians all the time. And 8 years after the publication of this book in 1925, the two churches merge and they become the United Church of Canada.
Stop. Oh my gosh, Reagan, we just published our Miss Cornelia episode, and we talked a little bit. We were so befuddled about why she took such a hardline stance against Methodists. We were trying to do some research and figure out, like, okay, well, what was going on? What were, like, the tensions between these two faiths at the time? Truly, we were coming up with nothing.
Yeah. It's
like minor doctrinal issues, minor theological issues. And I kept saying, I was like, well, I don't know. Maybe, you know, the Methodists were like a slightly newer faith. And so, like, maybe they would have been seen as more upstart or something. I mean, we were grasping at straws. And now to know that it all just came to naught anyway. Wow. Yep. Wow.
Yeah. And the United Church lives on. There's no Methodists, no Presbyterians anymore, but the United Church lives on.
Wait, you don't have Methodists or Presbyterians in Canada?
I mean, like tiny sects, but United Church is one of the three big ones. So we have the three big Christian denominations are Catholicism, Anglicanism, which is your Episcopalian, right, and then United. Yeah.
No way.
Yeah.
Okay.
Like my hometown has three churches and we have a Catholic
lot of
church.
Christian denominations
yeah.
in America. It's overwhelming.
Well, honestly, you guys have like a religious like revival thing every time you turn around. You're like, oh, new religion. I'm fascinated by like new North American religions.
Us
but yeah,
too.
No, like my tiny town, hometown of 1,000 people has three churches and we have one Anglican, one Catholic, and one United.
Oh, that's so, you know, interesting.
Like, yeah. It is nice. It makes the choices
easier,
right? Like,
yes,
it's multiple choice.
Yeah. Yes.
You pick, and it's really just like your, how seriously do you take transubstantiation? Pick one of these.
No, literally, yes, that is the difference.
Seriously, yeah. Kind of seriously.
It is, you are literally consuming the body of Christ.
Yep.
Catholicism.
You're doing it metaphorically, but you like the fancy stuff. That's Anglicanism.
Yep. Anglicanism, or this is all just metaphor.
Yeah.
Oh my God, that's really interesting. I wish, okay, so none of the books get written. Rilla takes place obviously during World War One. So we never get to hear what Miss Cornelia thinks about this. I would pay good money.
I would love to know.
Whatever. I'm going to appoint myself to write this bit of fanfic. I've already decided that I need to write Cornelia and Marshall's entire love story. Now it is time for me to also write Miss Cornelia reacts to this news.
This is going to shake her faith, or she's going to start her own religion.
Yeah.
That's what we do in America, is if we don't
Right. If you don't like it, you start your own. And you get tax break.
I do think where the weird distinctions between basically versions of non-Anglicanism Protestantism, which is really what is happening here. It's like a rural, particularly an Atlantic Canadian thing, but a rural thing, because the Catholics were always like there, like othered, right?
That's their thing.
And the Anglicans tend to be in these kinds of communities wealthier.
Mm-hmm.
And so then you have like this
in the
kind
Blue
of
Castle.
The Sterlings, I was just gonna say. Yeah.
And so then you have this just sort of fighting over the remaining. And they all come from like Presbyterian's mostly Scottish, right?
Yep.
Methodist is English, I think, primarily. So it's just like where they're coming from in
Which part of the British Isles did you come from?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Oh man. Yeah. How strongly do you believe in predestination?
Yeah, I was gonna say, because they're all a little bit with the predestination.
Yep.
They're all a little Calvinist. Anyway, sorry, we're off topic again.
No, that's a great segue. The religious language here does feel a little overwrought for me too. But, you know, hey, I'm not a parent, right? I do think that, you know, in that moment you have that life-changing experience. I could see giving it some religious symbolism.
I mean, I thought my baby was the most beautiful baby to ever be a baby, but I did not think she was Christ-like. I mean, she's cool, but
you know, parents are going to love their kids the way they're going to love their kids. I'm not judging. And I actually do have kind of a funny family story that I'll share here. So my younger brother was born a few days before Christmas. I think he and my mom might have come home from the hospital on Christmas Eve. She'll listen to this and correct me, I'm sure. But at that time, my parents really loved the song Christmas Must Be Tonight by the band. And I remember them playing it a lot when my little brother was brought home. I was like 2. So I thought there's a line that's the little baby boy who brings the people so much joy. I literally thought that was my brother. I didn't get that was Christ.
Amazing.
First of all, now you have to sing that line because I can't pull up the melody.
Our little baby boy brings the people so much joy. Son of a carpenter, Mary carried the light. This must be Christmas, must be tonight.
Huh.
Yeah, it's like a hippie Christmas carol.
I can see why 2-year-old Kelly thought that was written for your brother.
Oh, I definitely did. I'll always send him a link to a YouTube video of that song on his birthday.
Aww.
Yeah. Anyway, Anne names the baby James Matthew, and Jem is a perfect nickname for him. He's named after Captain Jim and Matthew, of course, Anne's two father figures, neither of whom had any other namesake. And this is contrasted to a woman in the Glen who had named her baby Bertie Shakespeare. And hilariously, we will see that kid pop up in Anne of Ingleside in the future. Maud is good about being pretty consistent with her random characters.
Except they're in the characters of Wendy Poplars, who existed for a small period of time and disappeared into the ether, never to be heard from again.
Because that book shouldn't exist.
That's a little bit of the problem.
Yep. Also, in contrast to Joy's birth, Anne's recovery is happy and swift, and it's not long before she's receiving regular visitors. And as before, Anne's first excursion out of the house, leaving baby Jem for the first time alone with Susan, is to Captain Jim's lighthouse. It is during this little visit with Captain Jim that he tells Anne about his hope to die just as the summer sun rises. A few episodes ago, we read you that lovely passage in Captain Jim's episode, but it really highlights the balance of birth and death in this book. Jem came into the world at sunrise, and Captain Jim will leave for his next adventure at sunrise as well.
It's really hard for Anne to leave Jem for the first time. Like, she really frets over whether Susan will know what to do when he cries. And when Susan's like, don't worry, I'll just put a little hot water bottle on his tummy. She's like, no, not too hot. Like, I get that.
Well, and also Susan has been there ever since the baby is born. So I think Susan probably knows the ropes at this point.
It doesn't feel like it, Kelly. It just doesn't feel like it the first time. The first time Steve and I left Alice, we both left her at the same time, was actually you and Chuck invited us to take some extra tickets to see the Book of Mormon with you.
Mm.
So it was only the chance that we're like, woo, free chance to see a great show. You guys had good seats too. That convinced me to do it. Two of my friends babysat Alice together because they were nervous. Each of them was nervous to do it alone. They're like, well, we'll do it together that way.
Oh, that's funny. Yeah. Alice had two babysitters.
Yeah, Brooke and Adrian like babysat for her. And you know, she mostly just slept, but it was a little nerve-wracking.
That kid has always been so loved.
Aw, yes, yes. We get to see Anne as a mother just a little bit, and she's as adoring and loving as we knew she would be. We also get this funny little bit in here that, again, reminds us and reminds Anne that ideals and abstract aren't the same thing as actual reality, especially in motherhood. And that's true still. So many people are convinced that they know exactly the perfect way to parent to turn out the perfectly behaved kid before the baby arrives, but all bets are off once the baby is here. As we talked about in our How Not to Parent episode, there's no one perfect way to parent, only leaning into being responsive and flexible to your individual kid and family, but Anne doesn't know that yet. And prior to Jem's birth, Anne had read a book called Sir Oracle on the Care and Training of Children. I tried to look it up. I don't think it actually exists. I think Maud made that up. And that book advocated for talking to infants in complete sentences and classical language rather than baby talk. Anne had been very impressed by this and had told Gilbert she planned to make, quote, an inflexible rule, never under any circumstances to talk baby talk to her children. She and Gilbert vowed to do so. And we see that modern influence of science here in the reading of parenting books. But like medical science at the time, it's not exactly fully formed. But then the text tells us, quote, Anne shamelessly violated their compact the very first moment little Jem was laid in her arms. Oh, the darling itty-wee sing, she had exclaimed. Gilbert teases Anne about that, but Anne says, you can't help talking baby talk to a baby. It comes natural, and it's right. It would be inhuman to talk to those tiny, soft, velvety little creatures as we do to great big boys and girls. Babies want love and cuddling and all the sweet baby talk they can get. And while Sir Oracle might not have known it at the time, Anne is actually right. So did you know there is a term for the way we talk to babies, and it's called mother-ease or parent-ease, and it's consistent across different languages. And when we talk to babies, we speak more slowly, we use shorter sentences, repeating phrases, often speak in the third person, speak in a higher pitch, and use kind of a musical sing-song voice. We even shift vocal timbres. It's more exaggerated and playful, and it actually helps babies develop language by capturing their attention and exaggerating the important parts of language, emphasizing sounds in a way that helps babies differentiate between sounds and where words stop and start, and emphasizing the important words in a sentence. It's actually a very important tool for learning language and for bonding with your baby. So, child development 101.
I love when we get your little parenting lessons, Reagan.
It's so funny when you realize that something that has been denigrated, that comes so naturally, obviously, to mothers and women,
mm-hmm.
traditionally coded in that way. And actually, then once you study it, you realize, like, actually, no, we did know what we were doing all along. This is actually very important for babies.
Mm-hmm. Instinct is important. There's a reason.
Well, Gilbert responds to Anne's baby talk and her defense of baby talk by hugging Anne and Jem and saying, oh, you mothers, God knew what he was about when he made you. And I don't know. I just love that little moment for Anne.
Yeah. At this point in the book, Leslie has worked through her bitterness so thoroughly that she is just as invested as Anne in adoring and loving on little Jem. Just as Jem's birth was a corrective experience for Anne, so it was for Leslie. And Anne and Leslie spend many hours doting on Jem and being fascinated by his every coo and gurgle. And the last little chapter on Anne's motherhood in this book involves the decision to leave the House of Dreams and move to a bigger house in the Glen, a house that Gilbert points out will have room for more children. Anne knows it's the right thing to do. But leaving the House of Dreams is so hard. It represents the entire gamut of these first 2 years of their married life. It was the place that she'd held little joy for her single day on Earth, the house where Jem was born, and the house that held so much newlywed happiness and joy and friendships. But choosing to move away from this home of her heart is one way that Anne is moving into the practicality of motherhood, the way we often have to give things up because they're better for our children and families. This grief of recognizing the need to leave the little house is heightened by another marker of the passage of time, the shortening of Jem's little baby dresses. Quote, Anne and Leslie had another cry the next week when they shortened little Jem. Anne felt the tragedy of it until the evening when in his long nightie she found her own dear baby again. But it will be rompers next, and then trousers, and in no time he will be grown up, she sighed.
Oh, that's one of the tiny heartbreaks of motherhood. Seeing your child gradually leave their younger self behind. Like every moment of independence and growth takes them further away from you. And it's supposed to work that way, but it's still like a little sad. The flip side of that tiny heartbreak, though, is of course getting to see all the new milestones and experience your child grows into. Everything they leave behind is replaced by something gained. And that's like that flip side, that balance of beauty and pain of being a parent. And of course, sentimental, romantic Anne, the one who once cried, how horrible it is that people have to grow up and marry and change. Of course, she feels this loss so keenly, maybe more keenly than many people. But change is the one certainty of life, right? And Anne's journey to motherhood with its hopes and despairs and grief and joy that is just beginning in this book is no exception.
Okay, I'm going to transition us to our inspired by and everything, but is there any other like points we want to make before we like kind of leave this thing?
Closing thoughts, Brenna.
No, I think we've covered it really well. I think part of what is lovely about this book is that it really is the transitional book into Anne's adulthood. And I know that for a lot of Anne of Green Gables fans, they don't love the next few books because we transition away from Anne's perspective and start to follow her children. But I really like that. I think that we've had such a thorough experience with Anne's growing up. And now it's almost like we're sort of sending her off truly into adulthood at the end of this volume.
Yeah, I think that's right.
And there's something in that experience of Maude really writing children and young adult experiences. Those are the perspectives she's interested in. She's interested in how we grow up, how children grow up and become the people that they want to become.
Well, and in many ways, the next few books are like, what if Anne's life hadn't been shaped by that initial tragedy? What if Anne had been born into that family that wanted her and could stay with her from the beginning? What would that have been? Right. And so in that way, I find the series joyful as it continues, because we do get to see that other version of what could have been.
Right. When you think about the part of parenting that is kind of reparenting yourself, Anne gets to do that with her kids.
Yeah, she does. Yeah.
Yeah. She gets to give them an easy, loving childhood, young childhood that she didn't get until she was already, you know, well on her way to growing up by the time you're 11.
Well, I am very much looking forward to all of our discussions moving forward about Anne of Ingleside and Rainbow Valley, and especially Rillo, another really emotional, rich text. Y'all, we did such a thorough job of discussing Anne's journey to motherhood in this episode that we are going to skip our Birch Path and our Puff Sleeve segments entirely and jump right into how we are all inspired by Anne. And for this, you guys, I have an idea. What is your favorite baby gift, either that you received or your favorite gift to give someone who is expecting a new baby?
Ooh, good question. I often try to sew something for a new baby And I usually do a baby blanket and one of those little taggy blankets. They're like little square pieces of fabric size for a baby to hold. And they have silky ribbons around the edges, like clothing tags. I made one for Alice as because when I was pregnant with Alice, I was a basic sewer. So like the square was perfect. Things that were square were the things that I sewed.
That's so funny to me to reflect on that, Reagan. And you're like such an accomplished sewer now. I didn't realize that you had just taught yourself to sew when you were pregnant with Alice. For some reason, I just assumed you always had that skill.
Mm-mm. You too, baby. Yeah. No. I learned from the internet and I made a zillion burp cloths because if your seams are wonky, whatever, the baby's going to spit up on it.
Totally.
But those taggy blankets were easy to sew and also babies freaking love those things. I made one for Alice as a baby and she adored it. And it was her primary like transitional object. She'd cuddle it and she'd suck on the ribbons. I always tell parents that it's magic and it totally, totally is. Because it's the perfect size to be a lovey that gets carried around and you can like attach it to the stroller through the loops to cut down on it getting lost. And it was a surefire way to help Alice self-soothe when she was upset. I was actually worried she'd like grow up to go to college still holding it by the tag clutched between her teeth. Like the year that she was like between 18 months and like two, I think 90% of the pictures I took of her, she had that hanging from her mouth. So, but it got lost. And despite the backups I made for her, they never took. So we did cold turkey on the lovey situation.
That's interesting. None of the backups ever took. I wonder what it was about that one.
I know. I thought I was going to be
smelled
smart.
Or felt a certain way.
Here's what I should have done, which is that I made two. Mm-hmm. I made several, but I made two that were exactly the same with like the same fabric and the same ribbons. And some of the other ones were different fabrics. And once she had decided on a favorite one, I should have alternated with the other one that looked like it. Because by the time she lost it, that one was like worn in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right. And so like the other one that looked like it probably, she knew it was.
She knew it was a fake. Yeah.
So I often gift those. I usually gift a picture book too. And that changes around depending on what I see. But I often like to give The Big Orange Splot by Daniel Pinkwater. It was one of my favorite books from my childhood. And it's still just a lovely book to read to kids today. And I also love to give Please Baby Please by Spike Lee and illustrated by Kadir Nelson. It's so cute and it's perfect to read to toddlers. Mm. And then I try and be practical and also do like Target gift cards for diapers and all the stuff you don't realize until you do. And then a Grubhub gift card so that parents can eat because that's really important.
Yeah. Yeah. That is the big one. Well, as the person without kids, I I feel like I get to be a little chaotic.
I will take this moment here to remind you of the $50 linen crown.
So I feel a lot of freedom in baby-related gift giving. I think moms usually give the thing they thought was most useful when their kids were babies, right? Like that person at the baby shower who like gleefully hands over those little snot sucker things as a gift, which I'm like appalled by. I mean, gross.
I'm appalled by it too, to be honest.
Do not give me a snot sucker under any circumstance. Yeah. But that's always like the Rachel Lind, right? That's always the super experienced mom who's like, this will save your life one day. And I'm just in the corner cringing. So I'm usually the person who ends up giving a gift that is totally silly or like too expensive or precious to like really be useful for a baby. And as I hear myself saying this, I'm realizing that I am the Leslie like giving the like too beautiful for daily use dress. I'm the Leslie. Okay. So I really love the website Maisonette for just impractically lovely baby clothes. I especially love to give as a gift their little baby bonnets, which always have these like sweet vintage floral patterns. And I love to give a beautiful picture book to babies. One that I gave recently is Life by Cynthia Ryland and Brennan Wenzel, which is a super gorgeous book about all the creatures on Earth and our place in the world.
That's one of our favorite bedtime books.
Is it really, Brenna?
Yeah, it is. That,
oh,
and also,
I love that.
He has one called They All Saw a Cat, which is a cat from the perspective of all these other animals. So like you see the cat through like the fly's perspective. So it's like the cat through the multiple eyes. And then you see the cat as the fish sees it, which is just this giant like face looking into the fishbowl, like about to eat it. And it's a really cool one for perspective.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah. Yeah, his art is amazing.
I love this age that Alice is, but I do miss picture books.
Yeah.
Kelly was an excellent picture book giver. She gave us quite a few gorgeous picture books. How about you, Brenna? What do you like to give or get as a baby gift?
I feel like I don't remember a lot of gifts. I remember one person at work who gave me like this big bag of clothes that she had just found at Value Village, which is like our thrift store. And she was like, I just thought all these were cute. And I was like, this is awesome.
That kind of is awesome, actually. Yeah, that's so like low pressure. It's like, hey, so if you like it, great. If not, not. It's like, I didn't spend a lot of money on this and have fun.
It was awesome. And it was directly contrasted with the person at work. This was at my old job, so I feel like it's okay to say this, who gave me a bag of like beautifully like pressed baby clothes that were hand-me-downs from her kids. And then she said, I need all of these back.
Stop.
So I put them all in a drawer and never touched them.
I need all of these back. Who says that with hand-me-downs?
And then like a year later, I was like, here you go. Leaving that job, I was like, thanks for this, baby. Because I knew it was going to get lost. We had
or spit up on, or diaper explosion, or whatever.
Yeah.
Babies are not known for keeping clothes in pristine condition. That is bananas.
Yeah, it was bananas. But my favorite thing to give is I'm a big fan of like the weirdly specific in-joke onesie that I find on Etsy.
Nice.
That's a favorite thing to do.
Yep.
When I went on maternity leave, I was coordinating the gender studies program at the college I worked at the time, and all the gender studies instructors got together and they gave me a bunch of things, including this one onesie that said like, girls who like trucks and boys who like trucks and girls who like dolls and boys who like dolls and anybody who likes anything. And it was just super cute. So I love finding like any kind of super that is specific to someone's interest onesies. And then I always like to give a board book library.
Next level.
Yeah, because then like little hands can play with them right away and you don't have to worry about their durability. And my favorite one, and this I give this to everybody, regardless of their level of interest or politics, there's a board book called A is for Activist, and it's alphabet book for little radicals. And I give it to everybody because it's great.
I love that.
A is for Activist, that. Abolitionist, and Ally. I know that one off by heart.
Oh, that's so good. Yeah. Although that reminds me of a book that I gave to a theater-loving friend, talk about niche interests. A is for Audra.
Nice.
And it is a alphabet book about all of Broadway's leading ladies.
Amazing.
Wonderful. I got a fair number of, because her name is Alice, we got a fair number of Alice in Wonderland various things, which is great. So we have
Reagan is all like, you guys clocked it. Good job.
That's good. But you know what? That also, I got a lot of those and I bought a lot. They were very popular at the time when she was little, was like, there was a series called like Baby Lit board book. So I have like a little Alice in Wonderland one. There's an Anna Green Gables one.
There sure is. We have it.
Nobody gave me that one.
How do we not have that one, Reagan? How do we not, in our crazy like Anne collection. Library at this point, I get on it. Oh, that's great.
Well, I love how we all recommended baby books.
Yeah.
I feel like it's important for babies to grow up surrounded by books.
Yeah, I love what you do, Brenna. Just like put books in their hands.
Yeah.
They should be excited about holding books in their little hands, even when they're babies. Mm-hmm. Oh, man. Oh my gosh, this was so much fun. Kindred Spirits, thank you so much for joining me, Brenna, and Reagan as we discussed motherhood, its sorrows and its joys in Anne's House of Dreams. Brenna, thank you a million for joining us. We had so much fun laughing and talking with you and hearing about your passion for this book and your own experiences of motherhood. This is a really special conversation. I'm glad you're here.
Aw, thanks so much for having me. It's always really fun to come and visit you guys, and I look forward to coming back again soon sometime.
Yes, we can't wait. Brenna, in the meantime, while we're waiting for our next fix of you, where can our listeners find you?
So I am on Blue Sky and Instagram at Brenna C. Gray, which is Gray with an A. And you can listen to my young adult podcast, Hazel and Katniss and Harry and Star, anywhere you find podcasts.
And I definitely need to co-sign the recommendation for Brenna's podcast. As we record, she just dropped an episode about the book Whale Rider. It sounds so phenomenal. I can't wait to get my hands on that one.
Thanks. I love talking about YA stuff and adaptation, and yeah, it's good fun.
Please join us next time as we continue to explore the themes of this book and look at the way that Anne builds community and friendships as a new adult. We would love it if you would continue to share the podcast with the kindred spirits in your life. Please let us know if you've reviewed the podcast on Apple Podcasts or if you've shared about us on social media, and we will send you a high quality vinyl KSBC sticker. It looks just like our logo, like sage green with the little like Anne silhouette. So reach out and let us know how you shared the pod via email at kindredspirits.bookclub@gmail.com. Or go ahead and DM us on Instagram at kindredspirits.bookclub. Please be sure to give us a follow on Instagram while you're there. We are always posting fun bookish content. We are both on Instagram pretty regularly, so it is a great way to interact with us, to get recommendations, and see pictures of our ever-growing collections of Anne books. Kindred Spirits, thank you so much for listening, and please join us next time.